thank you all for coming. It's always exciting to see readers and writers in here. It's my favorite part of my wife owning a restaurant. So welcome to Elaine's. I'm Jeff's, my wife Cynthia's restaurant. We're Alexandrian cuisines, Middle Eastern with French and Greek influences. And we've turned this into a literary salon. I think we've interviewed in excess of 100 authors since we've opened. And it's been really my joy to be able to meet all these really talented creatives. Jeff Markowitz is the author of 6 novels, including his new book, The Other, a dual timeline historical about standing up to hate. Jeff spent more than 40 years creating community-based programs and services for children and adults with autism before retiring in 2018 to devote more time to writing. In October 2021, an epic late-night puzzle hunt based on his novella, Motive for Murder, raised more than $1 million for at-risk children in New York City. Jeff is a past president of the New York chapter of Mystery Writers of America. He lives in Monmouth Junction, New Jersey, with his wife, Carol, and 2 cats, Virgil and Anus.
Not Anus.
Okay. Yeah, that's not as cuddly, is it?
Anus, as in the book that was written by Virgil.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that makes more sense. I was going in a completely different direction, Jeff. So, well, welcome to Elaine's. It's really great to have you here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about The Other?
The Other is a story about standing up to hate, and it was inspired. I was researching a different story idea, and as probably you've all experienced on the internet, there are days where you just go down a rabbit hole. And I went down a rabbit hole, and when I came out, I was reading an essay about the first Nazi youth camp in America, which opened in 1934. On the banks of the Delaware Raritan Canal in New Jersey, 6 miles from Princeton, 6 miles from my house, in a location where I have canoed and hiked thousands of hours over the last 50 years. And I had never heard any mention of this Nazi youth camp. And I started to talk to people and look around it. And no one that I knew in the area knew anything about it. And I decided I wanted to write a story set on the banks of the canal in the 1930s. It was an interesting time because when you think about canals today, I mean, the Delaware Canal is a recreational area. It's hiking, canoeing, fishing. But it was built for commerce. It wasn't built so that people could relax and have fun. It was built to transport anthracite from Pennsylvania to New York City. And by the 1930s, it no longer was making money because there were less expensive ways to transport anthracite from Pennsylvania to New York City in the 1930s. The railroads had the bulk of the business. Trucks were starting to get business. And the company that owned the canal shut it down. So you now have a situation where all of the people who live along the canal, whose livelihoods depended on the canal, didn't know what was going to happen to them. So you've got a situation of that kind of economic stress, and social stress. And now, for reasons unrelated to that, the American Bund decides it's a good place to put 200 German-American youth in brown shirts marching up and down the canal and preparing for what they hoped would be the allegiance of essentially Nazi America with the Third Reich. I'm not a historian. I don't write nonfiction, and I believe that fictional accounts of historical events are oftentimes the best way to get to some of the emotional truths. And like most authors of fiction in that situation, I said, what if? And in this case, I said, what if the lock tender on the canal, who has his house right there because he manages the lock, what if he were Jewish? In fact, he wasn't. He was Dutch. But I'm a fiction writer. What if he's Jewish? Of course, he's going to be the only Jewish family in the town. And now he's not only worried about whether he's losing his job and his house, but he's got the much bigger question of what's he supposed to do when 200 teenage and pre-teenage boys dressed in brown shirts are setting bonfires and marching and practicing for whatever they're practicing for. And it just became a story that I felt I needed to tell.
Jeff, what is it when you say, like, you know, because you're a curious guy and you read a lot, and when you, so you see new facts all the time. Mm-hmm. What is it about this one, like, that just kind of stuck out? I know you're doing the what ifs. I think a lot of writers do that. Yeah. I do it all the time. But why this is like a novel length work?
I think there were a couple of issues. One is because that particular location is very personal and meaningful for me. I mean, I literally spent 25, people used to talk about where a lot of people would commute to New York City, you know, and they would talk about, you know, their commute and the problem with the bridge and just no different than around here. And I would post pictures of my commute and the bridge I had to cross, which is this tiny little bridge across the canal. I mean, I basically have lived my adult life there. So it was very personal to me. It's also, for a lot of reasons, a time where I'm thinking more about what it means to me to be Jewish. I'm not particularly observant, but I am Jewish. It's my heritage. It's my family. It's everything. You know, it's part of my identity, and that's become a more urgent question of late. And in fact, that led me to the decision to write this as a dual timeline story. So there is a story that takes place at the lot tender's house on the canal in the 1930s. And there is another story that takes place in the lot tender's house in 2023. So it becomes a conversation both about Nazi activity in the 30s and about a resurgence of Nazi activity in America today. I've always written stories that are more light entertainment. And I think I felt some responsibility that writers have a unique opportunity to influence the public conversation. As I said, because I do think fiction, you can approach people with a fictional story in a way that they may pay attention to and may empathize with and may be able to relate to, where if you were telling them the factual account, they might very easily dismiss, because we've gotten very good at hating others, you know, in this society, and I wanted to address that.
Do you think that the readers are able to do that just because it's by making a fiction, they can kind of disassociate a little bit with their political opinions or whatever it is they've locked on?
Well, I think that what I think all writers share, particularly all fiction writers share, is an ability to make the reader care about a character. And if I can make you care about someone, I'll give you a good example. I'm sure any number of people here have read S.A. Cosby. Right? And when he includes a character in his story who is a trans character, who didn't have to be trans for the purposes of the plot, but simply becomes a real person in the story, readers will relate to that character in a way that is, I think, different than they do in real life. And you at least have some hope that moving forward, having sort of had that empathetic experience, that people might, that might have some ability to impact on how they approach the world that they live in. Whether it happens or not, I'll be damned if I know. But I do think that's what the role of being a fiction writer is all about, is to introduce readers to worlds they wouldn't otherwise ever see.
So you mentioned you've written like lighter things, yes, and maybe haven't delved into something that's as heavy as, yes, this topic. Did you have any challenges when you were trying to like tell a fun, emotional story and also mention, you know, like deeper subjects? Like, did you have to balance that?
It was interesting. I mean, I think that there have been times in some of my earlier works where if I had to choose between something that moved the story forward versus something I thought was funny, I would choose the funny, you know, because that's what I wanted to write. I made conscious choices as I was writing the story to avoid defaulting to the humorous version of the story. In the 1930s story, one of the things that's just an interesting aside is that's also when Albert Einstein moved to Princeton. And he moved to Princeton escaping Nazis in Switzerland. And I knew that I wanted to give him a small role in the story. I knew initially it was just, you know, a cameo. And had it been one of my earlier books, his role would have been to be comic relief. And I gave him a couple of little bits where he lightens the mood, because I think the game is in some sense consistent with at least how we view his persona. But he, and then more importantly, his wife, became really important parts of the storytelling. In a way that was very different than it would have been in my earlier books. And I had to discipline myself as a writer to remind myself what I was doing.
So they say, like, you know, everybody is a hero of their own story, right? So when you write antagonists, you want to have them with their proper motivations and things. So when you're dealing with, like, Nazis, and you're talking about anti-Semitism and racial bigotry and all that, How do you portray them without having it be like cartoonish or too over the top? Or how difficult is it as a writer to try to put your head inside somebody who's, you know, believing these kind of evil ideologies?
Well, the worst Nazi in the book is the man who is running the camp. So he's clearly the most evil, and he's also the one who potentially could become the most one-dimensional, cartoonish kind of character. So I did two things to deal with that issue. The first is when we first meet him, it's in a scene where he helps to rescue the lock tender's wife when the ice on the canal cracks. And it's before he knows that she's Jewish. So he does something heroic, if you will, or at least not evil.
It's your save the cat moment.
And only then, as he starts to discover that they're Jewish, do we start to discover that perhaps if he had known they were Jewish, he might not have been so quick to help. And then the lock tender happens to have a teenage daughter, and of course they're the only Jewish family in town. So while of course the family would like to be dating a Jewish boy, if she's going to date, it's not going to be a Jewish boy, because the only Jewish boy in the town is her twin brother. So, like many teenagers, boy and girl, we were more than willing to look past the potential flaws in a potential boyfriend or girlfriend if there's something about them that we find attractive. So, of course, Abe's daughter finds something attractive about Helmut. So it gives us some ways of keeping him from becoming that caricature of a Nazi.
Was that something that you planned at the beginning, or something you had to like fill out later?
I didn't plan anything at the beginning. I have evolved as a writer from someone who used to do a lot of planning to someone who just trusts I will find the story. And I knew a little bit about the story when I started to write it, but I didn't know a lot. And for the first maybe 20,000 words, I was literally writing 200 words at a time. You know, it could take a lifetime to finish a book at that pace. But that was as much as I could see ahead of me. It's like Doctorow used to have made a comment about writing where he said, in essence, you can drive from New York to Los Angeles in a dense fog, never being able to see more than 100 feet ahead of you, and make the trip safely. And that's the way I wrote the book. I could only see about 100 feet ahead of me, but I could see 100 feet ahead of me. I would write the 100 feet of story. I was happy with the 100 feet of story. And I trusted that there would come a point where the fog would lift and it would be like, wow, I can see all the way to the West Coast now. And in fact, I wrote the last 20,000 words in about 8 days. Because once the fog lifted, I was far enough into those 200 word at a time clips that the last third of the book, I could have written in less than 8 days if I didn't sleep. It was there. But I didn't plan anything.
Tell us a little bit about Abe and the character development and what's his journey, and without giving too much away.
Well, Abe is the lock tender. Like, his job is, if you think about the way canals are built, there are places along the route of the canal where there's a significant change in water level. So the canal builders built locks, which essentially function like an elevator for the ship. By letting water in or out, it evens the water level. The barge on the canal would pull into the lock. The lock tender would then release the gates in the lock, which would adjust the water level. So when the canal is a working canal, there has to be a person at the lock all the time in order for it to be safe for boats to travel. So the canal company gives the lock tender a house to live in. It's right next to the lock. And his job is to manage the lock. So if a canal is coming along coming down canal, as the barge is approaching the canal, the barge blows a whistle, which alerts the lock tender to the fact that this barge is coming. The lock tender then responds with either, in this case, it's either one or three bursts from his horn to let the barge know whether or not it's safe to proceed. And if it's not safe to proceed, the barge waits while Abe goes out and manually adjusts the lock so that it's safe for the barge to travel. So Abe is this man who, in the case of the story, is a Jewish man with a wife and two teenage twin children, who is the only Jewish family in town. He's not especially religious, but he's Jewish, you know, and certainly would like his children to be Jewish and would like his daughter to grow up to marry a Jewish man and be a housewife, you know, and raise Jewish children. And he's just a good, decent man who finds himself suddenly confronted by the reality that his wife and especially children are at real danger because there's 200 kids next door being whipped into a Germanic frenzy, and he doesn't know where that's going to lead. It leads to some horrible places. I mean, they are Nazis. I'm not going to make them caricatures, but they are Nazis. They do nasty things. And Abe's the next door neighbor. So he has to figure out what he's willing to do to defend his family. even at the cost potentially of his own soul, because sometimes we do things we don't necessarily like because we have a responsibility, whether it's to our family or to our community. And Abe finds himself in that dilemma.
When you're developing these characters, do you differentiate in your head between like external and internal arcs or growth? Because, you know, a lot of that is the external thing, but that definitely has an internal effect when you want character change. So do you think of that in advance, or do you sort of let the characters grow?
A little bit of both. There are pieces that I know. Like, I didn't know when I started the book what the kind of setting events were going to be that forces Abe into that kind of situation. And as a result, I didn't know necessarily how he was going to respond, but I knew he was going to find himself at some point in the story having to not just confront the external danger, but the internal questions as to what it means to him as a man, as a father, as a Jewish man, and what does it mean in terms of his faith or lack thereof with respect to his personal relationship to an entity that, for lack of a better term, we call God.
So you have this is a dual timeline. So you have a contemporary protagonist too, in Charlie.
Yeah.
What were some of the challenges with that? Was it easier in some ways going back and forth, or harder? What were your experience?
Going back and forth worked really well for me. I've often said that what I'm really equipped to do is write the great American novella. Like, give me 25,000 words, I'm all in. So in some sense, writing the dual timeline story was, in an odd way, sort of like writing two novellas, right? Except that they interact with each other, not in terms of plot. This is not kind of sort of like I like stories sometimes where it's a dual timeline story, and someone in the contemporary story is learning something about and solving, you know, a crime that happened 100 years ago. This is not that kind of dual timeline. But the two timelines are connected by a location, by a theme, by a set of candlesticks. And I theoretically could have written the two novellas, if you were, independently and then just alternated chapters. But I needed to understand the rhythm of the two stories. So I wrote them religiously, one and back and forth. So even though I think I knew the 1930s story, I knew a lot more about it than I knew about the contemporary story. I didn't allow myself to write further ahead, because each time you move from one story to the other, I need to know not just what's going to happen, but I need to know whether, based on what I just did in 1934, do I, in 2023, need to write something that's going to ratchet up the tension even more? Or do I have to write something that's going to give the reader a little chance to catch their breath and not feel so evil and threatened? And I couldn't do that. At least I couldn't do that. I'm sure there are authors like Jeffrey Deaver, God bless them, who can plot out every word in the book. You know, who would know where each storyline was at every moment, because that's what they do, and they do that extraordinarily well. That's not who I am, and that's not what I do well. So I really needed to alternate back and forth from one storyline to the other to keep the rhythm of the storytelling in line. I like Charlie, and I especially like Charlie's wife. For me, Charlie's wife became the character that enabled me to fully understand what the story was I wanted to tell.
As a writer, did it make it difficult for you jumping back and forth between two very different characters and different time periods? Like, was it hard to inhabit their heads when you're bouncing back and forth like that, in terms of like voice on the page?
It was less difficult than I expected it to be. And I think moving forward, I need to figure out how to write everything now. Because it's like, I can write a novella. I know how to do that, I think. But there was something, I guess once you're inside, I think all the writers in the room probably had the same experience. Once you're inside someone's head, you can leave it and come back, and it's still there. Like, I haven't written, because I started out 20 years ago writing an amateur sleuth mystery series about a female amateur sleuth in her mid-30s. I haven't written her in more than 15 years. But my guess is if I wanted to sit down today and write a new Cassie story, she's still in my head. So maybe it was just the previous. I write very short chapters to begin with. So the movement back and forth between the two characters is pretty rapid from a writing perspective. And my chapters, the book is 260 pages. There's got to be 65 chapters. So it's not like I'm writing 20 pages of Abe and then writing 20 pages of Charlie. It's pretty rapid back and forth. There's something about that structure that worked for me.
I'm interested in your character generation, because your characters have a lot of depth to them. Is that how much of that's planned out in advance? And how do you create these characters? Do you create them out of whole cloth, or are they somewhat based on people you know, or in this case, historical figures?
Most of them are created out of whole cloth, but I think that one of the things I learned pretty early as a writer, I think there's a lot of writers who do a fabulous job creating the main characters, whether it's the protagonist or the antagonist. But a lot of the secondary characters are almost cardboard kind of characters who just sort of exist to open the door or to answer the phone or to witness the crime or to discover the bloody glove. And when you're trying to create three-dimensional characters, if you make them interact with cardboard characters, I think your three-dimensional characters become less dimensional. So I've always put a lot of attention in finding small ways to make the less important, more minor characters real. And it's not about doing a lot of development. It's about finding something. Like, he's a really big man with tiny feet. And one can see this really big man with tiny feet wearing his Italian business suit. I got this guy. And it's a tiny feet to do it for me. So once I start to do that with the minor characters, it becomes easier for me to continue to flesh out and find in more depth and in more detail who my main characters are, because every interaction that they have is a real interaction, and it's not just about moving the plot forward, but it's about revealing kind of the depth in the characters.
You mentioned liking Charlie's wife. Have you ever had like a secondary character that you like so much they take a bigger and bigger role?
Oh, absolutely. In this particular book, that's true about Albert Einstein's wife, who initially wasn't going to be in the book at all. And then I realized, of course, Albert's not in Princeton alone. He's in Princeton with his wife. If there's going to be a scene, at Albert's house, he's got a wife. What never occurred to me was that she was actually going to become a compelling character, and I'm seriously considering writing an amateur sleuth mystery series. Don't make me regret this, because I do not want to write series set in Princeton in the 1930s, where Albert Einstein's wife Elsa is the amateur sleuth, because she just works for me. But I really don't want to write it. But it's one of those things that's been nagging at me. And it's his second wife. who happens to be his cousin, and whose job, if you will, is to let Albert be Albert and let Albert do his thing and his research and his studies at the Institute for Advanced Studies. And her job is to therefore manage their life, but it's her job is also to sign to kind of shield Albert from Albert groupies, you know. So she becomes to me a fascinating character, and I know it would make my publisher happy if I sent them an Elsa Einstein Amethyst series.
I think it's a great idea. So, when you're writing about real people, like what are the considerations, or the ethical minefield that you can kind of go through? Because it's a real human being who existed, right, with a legacy and everything. Like, how much leeway do you have as an author?
Well, I like to be at least respectful of reality, but I remind myself that I'm not writing Albert Einstein. I'm writing a fictional Albert Einstein. In the same sense that if you set a story in Chicago, yeah, it's important to get the landmarks right, but I'm not really writing a story that's set in Chicago. I'm writing a story that's set in a fictional Chicago, so I have some leeway. I think I want to be true to what we know about the character, in part because I just think that's responsible, but probably more importantly because I think readers really like that. But I also want to put the character in a situation which lets them respond in a way that I imagine they would, but in truth may not be accurate.
I just wrote a historical last year, so I know how difficult it is. How much research did you have to do on this, and how did it interfere with like your normal flow of writing?
I did more research for this book than I typically had to. I spent a lot of time. Everything about the Nazi youth camp in my book, in terms of the activities, is fictional. But everything about the Nazi youth camp in the book is based on historically accurate information about either that Nazi youth camp or other Nazi camps in America in the 1930s. And there were quite a few. I don't know that people realize. For example, there was a Nazi camp on Long Island in a town called Yaphank. And unlike some of the other Nazi camps, Yaphank itself is a Germanic community, and literally until 10 years ago, there were deed restrictions on the houses in Yaphank that if you wanted to sell your house, you were restricted in the deed to selling it to someone who was German, which is obviously illegal, but still existed as a deed restriction, and the way it was enforced, the deed restriction actually prevented you, if you wanted to sell your house, from advertising the sale publicly. So you were in multiple listings, which meant that the only people who knew that the house was for sale were other people who lived in the village. And 10 years ago, a family who lived in Yaphank wanted to sell their house to somebody who was not. You had to be either German-American or predominantly German-American. You didn't have to be 100% German-American, but you had to be at least. And they wanted to sell their home to someone who didn't fit that. And that was finally 10 years ago when the deed restriction was dealt with as illegal. So I tried to make sure that everything that I wrote is informed by history, but not necessarily real in all of its details, particulars. There's a particular event, you know, that happens at this Nazi camp in the book. It didn't happen in this Nazi camp in the 1930s, but it certainly happened in America in the 1930s. And I think in that respect, it's true to the history without being historical.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you. I'm curious, like you said, you've been writing for 20 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
And when did you first know you wanted to be a writer? What's your earliest memory?
Well, in high school, I was an editor of my high school newspaper. And I wrote a column in my high school newspaper. And I think I had this discussion with someone a couple of days ago. When I was in high school, my ambition was to be the next Art Buchwald. Now, today, I don't know if people even know who Art Buchwald was, but Art Buchwald was a syndicated columnist who wrote satirical essays as a way of commenting on social and political issues that were in the news. But at the same time, even though Art Buchwald was actually earning a living doing that, I had no concept at the age of 17 or 18 how you actually make money by writing. So I didn't. I will mention, because why not embarrass him, John, who's sitting right there, was my roommate freshman year in college. And if you had told either of us 55 years ago that either of us was going to be writing mysteries today and would be members of Mystery Writers of America, I'm not sure which one of us would have been more skeptical that that's where our lives were going to take us. But I always wanted to write. I wrote my first never-published novel in the late 1970s. It was a modern Buddhist parable about the nature of enlightenment. And it asked the question, is enlightenment something that an individual can achieve, or is it only enlightenment if we all get there together? Which is, in fact, historically a distinction between two historical Buddhist sects. There was not a lot of shelf space for that in Barnes & Noble in 1978. And in truth, it was not a publishable novel. 30 years later, after I had successfully had several novels published, I pulled it out of the file cabinet. It was written on green composition books by hand. I deleted 65,000 words, and the short story, The Soundbite, was published in an online e-zine based on that novel. And to this day, it may be my favorite thing I've ever written. But I didn't think about writing things that other people would read until about 20 years ago.
You know, that's why you never throw anything away, right? Yeah, I have to lie to yourself. You can always reuse it. In this case, it worked. Do you remember the first time, like, when story really captivated you? Like, any kind of story, a movie or a book or something, when you disappeared inside the story?
And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, Dr. Seuss, is probably the book that made me want to be a reader. And interestingly, when I go back and look at it, it's a book about a kid who makes up stories. When I think about the books that made me want to be a writer, I think about Slaughterhouse-Five. I think about Another Roadside Attraction, Tom Adams. I think about Confederacy of Dunces. Bona fides aren't in crime fiction, with a few exceptions. You can't not read Dashiell Hammett. I don't care, you know, what you like or what you read. I mean, there are certain books that, and I was a big, Hardy Boys fan. I actually own now several of the original 1930s Hardy Boys, and when I'm traveling, if I'm going to, I always both go into the used bookstores and look for the original, you know, 1930s copyright Hardy Boys. I think I have three of them at this point on the shelf. But my reading interests were not primarily in mystery and crime fiction until I discovered how much fun it was to kill people.
Is that what draws you to it, just the fun of writing?
Yeah.
Because a lot of times people write in what they read.
I always worry when I go to a mystery conference and I sit on a panel and people start talking about, you know, books that everyone, of course, in the room has read. And I go, not me. There are pieces of the genre that I read in now widely, but there's large chunks of the genre that are just not what I read. And I think, I mean, my influences tend to be more like authors like Kurt Vonnegut. I'm less interested in the whodunit puzzle part of the mystery than I am in the human part of how does the existence of the dead body or the threat of the dead body influence the living. You know, so while there may be, I mean, the book that Austin was gracious enough to publish for me, you pretty much know who the killer is in the first paragraph, even though he doesn't know. And it's not so much about solving the puzzle as it is going along for the ride and dealing with how the threat of somebody dying and or the reality of somebody dying changes the arc for the living.
And you think reading more widely helps you go deeper into like the psychology of it or into more universal truths in the human experience?
I guess so. Although I will also admit, since COVID, I read less than I used to, and I read shorter than I used to. I read a lot more short stories. I have a different attention span for reading than I did before.
Why is that?
I don't know. But I mention only because when I do, I almost always, there's almost always somebody else in the room who said, I've had the same experience. And it took me a while to, I mean, you would have thought sitting at home, I'm retired, I'm sitting at home, you know, I'm not going anywhere. You know, my house is full of books, including, you know, it's like me saying about to be read pile, you know, and someone told me, don't think of it that way. Think of it like a wine cellar. You know, you may never get to all of them, but it's nice to have them. You know, so there's always hundreds of books in the house that I haven't read. You would think I would do nothing but read during the early stages of the pandemic. I could not find the attention span to read. It was a really interesting experience.
Has that happened to anybody else out here? A couple of you? Yeah, interesting. So we're running a little short on time here. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about your process. Like, what do you write in? What are some of the tools you use? Do you give us a little bit about how this works?
All right. First of all, I write in the family room in my house, and up until a couple of days ago, on a desktop computer. I started writing that way 20-something years ago in the age where, A, you only had one computer in a family, and B, you know, you had to deal with when other people in the family needed the computer. So I would write at 5:30 in the morning before, first of all, I'm going to work anyway. I would write at 5:30 in the morning. Carol would be out walking the dog. My son would be sleeping before going to school. I didn't have to fight for the computer. And because that became my routine, that remained my routine long after those circumstances required it, because it became part of the discipline of being a writer. I think that a lot of times, you know, when people, especially like at conferences and aspiring authors want to know what's the process, the goal isn't to learn somebody else's process. The goal is to figure out what process works for you, and then to be disciplined enough to do it. It took me a long time after I retired. I thought initially that my process wasn't going to change at all. I was just going to move it back from 5:30 in the morning to a more civilized hour because I didn't have to go to work. And it didn't happen because I didn't know how to write at 10:30 in the morning. I knew how to write at 5:30 in the morning. It took me at least 2 years after I was retired to learn how to write at 10:30 in the morning. Now I can write any time of day because I've learned how to. But after spending probably 15 years, 5 days a week, getting up at 5:30 in the morning, spending an hour and a half on the computer before getting ready to go to work, that was the way I knew how to write. And you don't think necessarily from a process standpoint that it's tied to something so arbitrary and physical, but it is, or at least it was for me. I literally just a couple of days ago scrapped the desktop and invested in a laptop, only because I kept getting messages that my desktop was so old that it was no longer being supported by anything. And as every day went by, I became more and more worried about losing 15 years worth of files, back them all up onto USB drives and bought a laptop. And now if I can figure out how to transfer my Soundwave or my SoundTouch music system, I can throw away the desktop before it dies completely for the moment I still need it to listen to music. But I used to, when I was writing Amateur Sleuth Mysteries, I didn't outline, but I planned. I think when you're writing a whodunit, there's things you have to know. You have to know where it starts. You have to know where it ends. You have to know a couple of key plot points along the way. And in between those things, you can let the story take you and the characters take you where it wants to. But if you don't hit those key points along the way, when you get to the end, you don't have a satisfying whodunit. And I didn't outline per se, but I used to say that if you took all of the post-it notes that piled up on my bureau and put them in the right order, they would look an awful lot like an outline. It's just that, you know, they got written in 2 or 3 words on post-it notes whenever I thought of them, and then just went on the pile. As I've moved from writing whodunits to things that are more crime fiction, but not necessarily done it, I've begun to trust that I will find the story. So I need a premise. I knew I was going to be writing a story about how the existence of the Nazi youth camp was going to impact on somebody's life. And I do have to remember these days to go back and edit out the things that 6 months ago I thought might lead me to an interesting place and turned out to be a dead end. You know, and you don't want to leave those in the final version. But it was like, oh, that was really important, and it turned out to be totally irrelevant. You know, I either have to figure out a way to just get rid of it or to find some way to use it at the end to make it at least relevant that it was in the story. So there's more of those kind of dead end decisions that I have to make now. But it's been working for me.
I'm going to go to questions in a second. Just I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Austin published you, and your relationship with Level Best, right? So you've been with a few publishers. What's the most surprising thing about the publishing business that you've learned from the 20 years ago when you started writing this? How are your expectations shattered?
I'm in the room.
I think the very first book I wrote, I sent to a publisher. And he really liked the story, and he said to me, I'll be a reader, but I won't be a writer, I won't be a publisher, because, in essence, I don't know how to make money off of it. It doesn't fit my business model. So I used to think the idea was you wrote a really good story, you sent it to a publisher, they loved the story, and of course they published it. Forgetting that the way the publisher pays his or her bills is by selling your book. For me, it was a second. It's not really a career. For me, it was not how I paid my bills. So if it didn't sell really well, it was disappointing, but it didn't impact on things like whether or not my lights got turned off. But for the publisher, it does. So maybe the first real surprise for me was realizing the publishing was a business. And like most businesses, it's got a reality that I don't understand any more than I understand a lot of businesses. The longer I write, the less I think I understand the business, but the more I trust the people. I've been fortunate, and I'm not saying this just because Austin's in the room, because it's not about Austin, it's about his wife. I've been fortunate to do business with really good people. And whether or not a book succeeded as a business venture, I just came back from a day talking about how art, the intersection between art and technology, art and entrepreneurship, art and business. And one of the messages, again, is that the metric can't be financial. That if the metric by which we define success in the arts are financial, we are, most of us, most of the time, going to be failures. That the metrics that are important have something to do with the quality of the art itself and with the quality of creating art and of the importance in a world that's a little crazy of art. It's like now you hear all the debates about artificial intelligence, and the thing that I always respond is, if there's anything I know about AI, it's that AI doesn't have a soul. And whether I'm reading a book or I'm looking at a piece of artwork or I'm listening to a piece of music, the thing that's important to me about that creation is that it gives me a glimpse into the soul of the person who created it. And I don't care if AI can write a book better than me, or can compose a cantata better than me, or can do a sculpture that I could, because I'm not interested in it as a product. I'm interested in it as a process. I'm interested in it as, I say, an eye, a glimpse into the soul of the person who created it. And I think I've had the fortune of working with some publishers who, while they would like to make more money, have a commitment to the art that goes beyond just what size check did Ingram send us this month.
Yeah, I love that. I got to ask you the last question, because it's a follow-up on that. And I ask every author this. Well, where do you think story comes from?
I think that human beings are inherently, genetically, by nature, storytellers. But I think that in terms of where we find our stories, I think that again, whether we're talking about stories or other art, I think that creativity is about looking at the same thing everybody else is looking at and seeing something different. I don't say this necessarily as a matter of pride, but just as reality. I've got a fairly warped perspective. I think I see things differently than a lot of people. I know Dana sees the world very differently than a lot of people do. And I think that that informs our art. I think that's where our stories come from, because everybody else is looking at that thing, seeing this. You know, and Dana's looking at it, cursing the storm, and seeing something very different. But which means that he's got a story that nobody else has. And I think but I think we're born to be searchers. Let's say the book that made me want to read when I thought about it, that's on Mulberry Street, is entirely about how a kid every day when he comes home from school, his father asks him what he saw. And every day he makes up a story about what he imagines he saw, not what actually happened. And I think that really is the human condition.
That's a great answer. All right, I'm going to come around with questions. Anybody have a question? Just speak right into the mic so it gets picked up on the recording.
I just wanted to know a little bit more. You talked about process and writing 5 days a week. Is that something that you're very compulsive about?
No.
Okay.
When I'm actively working on a novel, I write at least 5 days a week, oftentimes 7 days a week. Usually early in the process, you know, I'd sit down once a day, write for maybe an hour, hour and a half. By the middle third of the book, I'm probably sitting down twice a day, writing a couple of hours each time. By the time I get to the last third of the book, I'm pretty much writing around the clock. But when I'm not actively working on a novel, it doesn't bother me if I go a week or two without writing anything. And I don't feel compelled to start a new novel as soon as I finish a previous one, which of course makes me less attractive to publishers, because it doesn't put me on the time frame of production that is the current business model. Theoretically, my book came out in November. The current business of publishing would say that I should have had my next book to my publisher by November. They should have already had my next book. I haven't started writing my next book yet, but I have gotten more interested in writing short stories, and I've been spending more time in between writing sources, because that does require that same commitment of I'm going to spend 5 days a week for the next year, you know, in this world.
Just as a follow-up, you mentioned your first Buddhist novel.
Yeah.
Since you became a regular writer, as it were, do you have any novels which you started and then realized this isn't going to work?
Yeah, when I was writing my Castiel O'Malley Mysteries, I was 20,000 words into the fourth Castiel O'Malley Mystery when I put it down and I said, done. And there were only one or two people at that point who get to see it, and they liked it. But I didn't want to write it. They just... And whether or not it was working or not, I felt pretty strongly that, A, I don't want to spend a year working on something that I'm getting bored with, and B, even if I've hidden it so far, if I'm bored with it, before I'm done, that's going to become pretty obvious to the reader. I still have those 20,000 words on the desktop and now on a thumb drive in case, God forbid, I have heard it. I actually made the mistake a couple of years ago of promising Maria O'Day that I would consider writing one more Cassie for her. because I don't want this to happen.
Other questions?
And of course, I don't want to put you on the spot. Have you started a novel at any point and realized that this is not commercial? No publisher is ever going to want to publish this. And if so, did you finish it?
Well, I wrote a story after Death in White Diamonds that I knew was not right for a traditional publisher of mysteries. But as a courtesy, I sent it to the publisher who had published the work previous to that, which was Death in White Diamonds. And they said to me, you know, nothing happens till the first 50 pages. And I said, the Vietnam War happened. And they said, well, no one died. I said, a lot of people died in Vietnam. And they said, we get the impression that's the story you want to tell. And they go, yeah. And they go, well, that's not the story our readers read. Which was absolutely true. I stopped a couple of things. Usually, if I like it, I plow through to the end. Because, frankly, I'm not a big enough name to sell books based on the first couple of chapters. So I got to write the whole damn thing anyway before those publishers are going to tell me, no, it's not for us. for good or bad, I'm in a position where, because I don't rely on royalties to pay my light bill, I can tell the stories that I want to tell. But I haven't entirely come to terms with the fact that I still want to be traditionally published. And if I want to be traditionally published, I can't ignore the publisher's realities. Like I said, I used to think, if I write a good book, a publisher's going to want to publish it because they want to publish good books. Until they look at me and they say, it may be a good book, but it has nothing to do with our business model. And that's an entirely legitimate and appropriate thing for publishers to say. I'm just stubborn enough to say, I'm going to write the damn story anyway. The only one that they literally just set aside and forgot about was that very first one, which actually, not only did it become a short story, but I did take one of the characters and use her in the Cassia Valley Mysteries to good effect. So I'm very green as a writer. You don't throw anything away, you recycle it.
Any other questions? All right, so what are you working on now and where can they find you?
Well, other than sitting here, the easiest place to find me, my website is very simply jeffmarkowitz.com. So that's probably the easiest place to find me. If you're on Facebook, I'm not one of these people who does an author page, so you can just look for Jeff Markowitz on there. My next book, unless it becomes the Elsa Einstein solving crimes in Princeton in the 1930s, which is a fabulous idea for someone who likes to write amateur mystery series. One day I'll figure that out. The project that I've committed to next is at least initially starting out to be true crime, although it might become crime fiction. I don't think so. I've been invited to write a book based on the life experiences of a 74-year-old member of the Gambino crime family who has gotten permission to tell his story and has invited me to be the author who tells it. He's assured me that my life will not be in danger, Briefly, yes, bluntly, I blamed it on my wife. I said, you know, I'm scared of you, Tony, but I'm really scared of my wife. And she made me promise to ask the question, so am I in any danger if I write the book? And that's when I was assured by multiple people that he had permission to tell his story, and that the only constraints were he's not permitted to implicate anyone in a crime that the authorities don't already know. So, but he said to me, most of the stuff we're going to be writing about, the people are dead. And the statute of limitations expired. So there are a couple of exceptions, and you do have to be willing to change the names. I chatted with a writer I know in the law enforcement world who suggested I shouldn't be surprised to learn that there may be photographs of the conversations that I have with this 74-year-old member of the Gambino crime family. But I don't think that's necessarily true. I don't think there's much that he has. There's a lot that he has to tell me that the general public doesn't know. I don't think there's very much he has to tell me that the authorities don't know. He's spent... He served 38 years, I think, in jail. His first prison sentence, got out of jail, planning to live the straight and narrow, and 7 years later was back in jail for a seven-year term that was shortened by 2 years because of COVID, and has been out of jail now for only about 3 years. So I don't think there's a lot that the authorities don't know. And as long as the authorities already know, and as long as he doesn't implicate somebody in something they don't already know, I'm really not too terribly concerned. And I'm an old man, if I'm wrong. I mean, it could be my pancreas. It could be the mob. I mean, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. But I'm looking forward to spending the second half of this year visiting with my good friend Tony and letting him tell stories. And I already have invitations to sleep over and cook with him, and it should be an interesting 2025.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I look forward to that. So Jeff has books up here for sale that he's going to sign. I just have two requests for you guys. If you could just jump on Amazon and give them a 5-star rating, that would be really helpful, because it, when people see those ratings, it makes them more likely to try an author maybe they haven't read before. And also, if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's, I'd appreciate it if you'd rate us on Open Table or Yelp or wherever you rate restaurants. So Jeff, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.